more of a technical talk, but anyway, I'm happy to be here. I'm pleased also that this is the last talk of the workshop. Maybe you keep these things in mind a little longer then. Indeed, my name is Jörn Bayer. I'm with PTB. PTB is the German, somewhat older sister of NIST in the US, or NPL in the UK. And I have to say, I'm embarrassed. I just wanted to look it up, but I'm embarrassed to say that I don't know what the Canadian National Metrology Institute is. Anyway, what I'm going to talk to you about is low-temperature superconductor DC squid sensors that we've developed and that can be useful for precision measurements in metrology. This is our job, but also for fundamental physics experiments. And the devices that I'm going to show you have been developed in our working group, cryosensors at PTB Berlin. So this is the outline of my talk. I'm going to tell you about what components LTS DC squid sensors have. There will be a little bit of overlap with a talk from yesterday, but not too much, I think. How are those devices operated? What are parameters? And I will talk a little bit about circuit and design aspects that may be interesting to you as a potential user. Things like how to efficiently couple a signal, whether it is necessary or not to use a squid cascade, not only a single stage, but a two-stage or three-stage sensor even. What are squid arrays and what they are good for? I added that because there was a question yesterday about that, and also things like flux trapping. There was here and there this notion that this is harmful, and indeed it is, and I'll talk about that a little bit. I will tell you also about some problems that DC squids have, and that is typically excess magnetic field flux noise at low temperatures. That is a little counterintuitive, but I'll show you how it looks. And then I will give you three examples of sensors that we've developed over the last years. And one is already in use for a dark matter experiment, and the others maybe. All right, so let's get started. So in most of the talks you have seen when a squid was mentioned, it was this ring with two junctions and sort of a black box. By the end of the talk, you may see that sometimes it is also helpful to have more than two junctions in a squid sensor. But let's start with a single one. So superconducting tunneling was discovered theoretically by Brian Jules more than 50 years ago. And he was considering what's happening when you bring a superconductor in contact with another superconductor. So you have two superconducting electrodes, and you have a thin non-superconducting interface. And what Josephson discovered was that there should be a supercurrent across this junction, which is nowadays called the DC Josephson effect. This supercurrent should have a magnetic field dependence, which we now call the current phase relation of the critical current. And there's also the AC Josephson effect, that is, there are high frequency currents across the junction when there's a voltage across it. And Josephson junctions as a term are any configuration of weakly coupled superconductors across some sort of non-superconducting region. And those non-superconductors can be insulators, normal metals, somehow structurally modified superconductors, or also magnetic materials. And there are examples of all these junction types. And very shortly after Josephson predicted this, there was already the experimental verification. So this is the current voltage curve of such a superconductor-superconductor contact. In this case, it was tin oxide, and lead. And Anderson and Raoul, they have seen that what Josephson predicted. So there is a supercurrent. So that is a current that does not produce a voltage drop across the junction. They have seen that this supercurrent, the IC, is dependent upon the magnetic field that this junction is exposed to. And what they also have used here is a superconductor insulator superconductor junction, SIS junction, that is made of a metal, a native oxide, and another metal. And this is pretty much all what you need in order to build a junction. And this is a cross-section of the process that we are using at PTB to fabricate these junctions. So this is a thin film process now. We are not using tin and lead anymore, but we are using niobium. And what you see here is the cross-section through a junction made from niobium at the bottom. This is this niobium 1, niobium 2 on the top. And this black region here is aluminum oxide. There are insulating layers. There's a normal metal that you need. This is, again, all in thin film technology on a silicon substrate. And if we zoom in, what this junction looks like, it's a bilayer from niobium and aluminum. You create this oxide by thermal oxidization, and you put another niobium on top of it. And this is also already quite a while ago that people have tested this and suggested this, but this is still the technology we are using these days. This is an SEM picture of the way we can do currently our junction. So horizontally here is the superconducting bottom electrode. You do photolithography, in our case contact lithography, and you can create minimum features, in this case this window and an insulating layer, where underneath you have the aluminum oxide, and then you put another superconducting electrode on top of it, and you have two junctions close by that you can wire up to build a DC squid. So a DC squid is this arrangement of two junctions in a superconducting loop. In addition, I think that was also mentioned yesterday, the junctions are resistively shunted in order to dampen high-frequency oscillations that occur. And this DC squid arrangement is fundamentally a sensor of magnetic flux through the ring, and the ring has an inductance L-squid.
Where are these high-frequency things coming from, and why doesn't adding a resistance to a superconductor make things worse?
The oscillations come from the AC Josephson effect that I mentioned.
Oh, okay.
So this is one aspect. And the R reduces the Q of this LC circuit. There's always, with this planar geometries, there are always capacitances involved. And you have this R to make the Q of this LC circuit. Well, to a certain extent, you can say that the noise that comes from this resistor deteriorates the performance of the squid. Mm-hmm. But you have to have it in order to operate it in the way you will see we do it. Okay, so the squid is a magnetic flux sensor, and of course, I think this is also the scheme we've seen yesterday, magnetic fields, electric currents, or whatever physical quantity you can turn into a magnetic flux through the loop can be measured with this. So this structure combines two superconducting effects. One is the magnetic flux quantization that states that a multiply connected superconducting arrangement like a ring below its TC obeys flux quantization, so the magnetic flux comes only in units of phi naught, where phi naught is 2 h over 2 e, and n is 0, 1, 2, 3, an integer, and the already mentioned Josephson tunneling. And the critical current of this device has the dependence, the cosine dependence that is shown here on the flux threading the loop. Okay, so these two cartoons now show what a user will see on an oscilloscope when he tests the device. And testing in this case means, for instance, taking an IV curve, applying a current, measuring the voltage, or taking a voltage versus flux curve. And this shows that to a large degree, DC squids can be considered some sort of resistive element above the critical current, and its resistance, the dynamic resistance, the tangent on the IV curve here, changes as well as the critical current with the flux seen through the squid. And this periodicity that I mentioned before shows up in the V-phi curve as this highly periodic, highly nonlinear response in voltage as a function of the flux that is seen by the squid. Okay, so I already here want to ask the question, how fast is the DC squid? Because in a way, you can see it already in this very simplifying diagram. So it's a structure that has an inductance and the already mentioned resistors across the junctions. So there is a time constant that is given by L squid over 2R. that is giving you the time scale at which occurrence through the device, around the device, can change. So with typical numbers, 100 picohenries for the squid inductance and resistors of the order of a couple of ohms, you will find that a DC squid intrinsically is a very fast sensor. So in the picosecond and below range, signals can change and principally can be measured. You have a hard time measuring a DC squid at these times because almost always there is negative feedback necessary to operate this device. We've heard the term flux-lock loop and also the principle yesterday in the talk. But what I want to point out here is that while there are some really serious advantages like linearization and the fact that you do not need to count fine knots, but also can measure signals, flux signals that are much smaller than fine knots, there's also one limitation, and this is in terms of bandwidth. What do I mean with this? Well, a simple, even an ideal FLL circuit has a limit in its bandwidth, and the FLL bandwidth, that is the bandwidth that the maximum frequency that the output signal can change, is effectively limited by your electronics, room temperature electronics, by the integrator, as is the slew rate, the maximum signal change at the output. So this can be visualized very, very simply. This is a negative feedback, so your preamplifier and integrator have an open loop gain, which is scaling with one over frequency, and the closed loop gain, the frequency response of your output signal with respect to an input signal is a low pass of first order, and the FLL bandwidth, F3dB, coincides with the so-called unity gain frequency of the electronics. And this is the ideal case. And you can say, okay, I make use of the fact that semiconductor electronics can be very fast, and you think you can sort of arbitrarily increase the bandwidth, which is unfortunately not true. And the reason for that is that there is a significant, typically a significant separation between where you operate your squid at low temperatures and where your preamplifier and integrator sits. And just to illustrate that, let's assume we have a 1 meter cable between the squid and the room temperature electronics, which is a usual number. You will have a delay time. That signal just takes round trip about 10 nanoseconds to go up, be integrated, and go down again. So in this delay time can be in this block diagram very simply introduced and analyzed. And what you will see, and I've plotted this here as the FLL gain as a function of frequency, and the frequency is in units of 1 over this delay time. You will see that when the speed of the integrator, the F unity gain frequency, which is also plotted here in units of 1 over TD, when it approaches significantly, let's say a few percent of 1 over the delay time, you will not have a smooth and less than 1, equal and less than 1 frequency response, but you get what we call gain peaking. And that indicates an FLL gain higher than 1, that you are not having negative feedback anymore, but that you have actually positive feedback. And of course, you don't want to operate your feedback loop in a situation like this. And using these numbers, this 8% of 1 over TD gives you at least still a flat frequency response anymore. Plugging in the numbers, you will find that if you have an integrator with a unity gain frequency of 8 megahertz, that corresponds to F3dB of about 18-20 megahertz, you are basically done as far as the FLL dynamics is concerned because of this delay limit. So with such an arrangement, you have practically a signal bandwidth from DC up to about 20 megahertz. All right, so I'll go through some main terminology aspects, if you will. So we've heard about magnetometers, and in our terminology, a magnetometer is directly measuring the magnetic flux density, as you see this here in the scheme. I put on here a comparably insensitive magnetometer, but it should show that in principle, and oftentimes this is also used, you use direct single coupling. So this is the squid loop, these are the junctions, the resistors, cooling fins, and the squid loop in this case here of the order of 30 micrometer diameter gives you a sensitivity B, delta B to delta flux in the squid of about 2 microtesla per fine knot. If you want to make a more sensitive magnetometer, you need to increase this device. And this is an example of a so-called cartwheel magnetometer. The chip size is now 3 millimeters squared, and the sensitivity goes down to 3 nanotesla per fine knot. I think in this community, mostly what is used is a signal coupling to a squid via a pickup coil, which is often superconducting, but doesn't need to be superconducting. So this would be this arrangement. The superconducting flux transfer loop is superconducting or base flux conservation, and the screening current is actually what you measure. And optimal signal coupling you achieve when you balance out impedance match, if you will, L pickup and L input, and you maximize the coupling directly into the squid. And of course, you would want to minimize, at best, avoid any parasitic inductances between the position where you pick up your signal and the position of the squid.
I guess this coupling, K, you want it to be close to 1.
Yes.
So how close to 1 can you get it? I bet it depends on the size and the application.
Yes, it depends on the inductance. Typically for, and I'll come to that, typically for a single squid, or let's say not for a single squid, but for direct coupling, I should say, you get K to 80%, 90%. That is possible. So it's a design aspect. And there also.
And it's purely passive? There is no losses from that?
There are losses, coupling losses, but what do you mean with passive?
I mean, if you were, would you, in a way, would you add the resistance because there is that part of the circuit? Is there additional noise coming from that?
There is additional noise if you need to dampen resonances that are associated with really physically making this coil. Yes, and you will see a circuit diagram later where we'll point out where this can come from. What I want to just simply point out here, if the magnetic shielding is not good enough, as we've heard, if you need this wire-wound gradiometer arrangement, you unfortunately automatically have a parasitic inductance just from the reference coil, which should not see any signal while the signal coil should see signal, of course. And another, so to say, terminology, if you have nothing at the input and you have just this arrangement, this is what we call a current sensor, and it measures the electrical current and the signal current. The signal coupling is here via this input inductance. I'll come back to the differences between a magnetometer and a current sensor later on. Oh, actually, not later on, but right now, because they differ in a way in sensitivity parameters. So with a magnetometer, again, you want to measure magnetic flux density. So the sensitivity parameter is an inverse of an area, which we call the effective area. It tells you the flux in the squid in units of phi naught that you get from exposing this device to a certain magnetic field. A current sensor has the delta I over delta phi squid input sensitivity parameter given in amps per phi naught. The noise, the sensor noise, is expressed in the units that we've heard yesterday as well, tesla per square hertz, or for the current sensor, current noise density, amps per square hertz. And the already discussed energy resolution is given in these notations here. So for a magnetometer, it is the product of the field noise in power units times the effective area squared. And for the current sensor, it is the current noise power density times the input inductance. And I want to point out that what, especially for the user in a way, what you always should compare two devices with based on is the coupled energy sensitivity. And these couplings, they are in this notation already included here, or coupling losses. And this coupled energy sensitivity, as we've heard yesterday already, can be expressed in units of H or H bar. Okay, another aspect that I want to mention here as well, and also say a few words more, is a squid cascade. So I think we have seen that in some of the slides as well. What is a squid cascade? A squid cascade is, simply speaking, reading out one squid with another. So a squid, as you have seen before in this IV plot, usually is operated by measuring a voltage that develops across the device in response to a change of the magnetic flux. But you can also operate the device by fixing a voltage across the device and reading out the current. So this is principally shown here. So the advantage is that by doing so, by using a cold amplifier, you reduce typically noise contributions from room temperature electronics. The disadvantage, obviously, is that this device is a little more complex. You need a little more wiring in the cold. The response curve can sometimes be a little more complex. And in the cold, you have also higher power dissipation, which is costly. Another aspect is that once you have current flowing out of the front end, you can also make use of it. Make use in the sense that you feed it back, partly at least, to the squid, and you can change in a positive feedback mechanism, you can change the amount of current that is the response to the same flux change. So in other words, we call this flux gain. So you increase the flux gain from the sensor squid to the amplifier squid. And this reduces the noise contribution from the amplifier to the front end. And two cascades are typically necessary when you really want to make sure that you want the ultimate noise overall, and you want to be really limited by the front end sensor. There is a little bit of a disadvantage that the dynamic range is reduced, but this is typically not a problem in situations where you have very small signal anyways, where you more are worried about the noise of the sensor squid. Well, yes, you can do that, but that also complicates the overall V-phi curve. So in a way, what this does, it increases the small signal flux gain. Right, so you don't want to get too complicated V-phi curves. I'll show you an example of a two-stage V-phi curve that looks like a single-stage V-phi curve. And you're right. In principle, you can also increase this. There is one aspect. Typically, the inductance that you have to add here in order to feedback is much smaller than the input inductance. So the dynamics in terms of L over R of this circuit is also typically hurt if you increase the inductance here. Okay, so the required input inductance of a current sensor is usually not determined by the squid, but by the source you want to read out. Okay, so it is in a way limited to a certain extent, on the low end, by the squid inductance itself. But if you want to read out a superconducting pickup coil of a microhenry, let's say, you have a problem because the squid inductance is typically in the range of, let's say, 10 picohenries to 1 nanohenry, and coupling a microhenry inductance to this is problematic. And so what often is used is a so-called double transformer input, which I just want to schematically show here. So you introduce a superconducting flux transfer loop in between your input coil and the squid. This is potentially problematic because, again, the superconducting flux transfer loop is susceptible to magnetic interference. It also affects the squid performance, if you will, in terms of its noise inductance, but also the input inductance. So it's a little more complex to design a device like this. And again, you also can have parasitic resonances that you may need to dampen, which costs noise. So, and double transformer, just the terminology again, because these are the two transformers. Sometimes people say this is a flux transformer, but this is technically not quite correct. Anyway, so sometimes it is also helpful to increase the inductance of the current sensor, not by using a flux transfer loop, but by using squid arrays where you, and this is schematically shown here, where you arrange squids in some sort of an array, I'll come to that, but the input inductances of all the elements are all in series. So you can get an n-fold increase of the total input inductance, of course.
What limits the size of the, you presented, you said that there were a few micron size pickup loops for the squid, and then you showed the millimeter.
Yes.
Why can't you go bigger so that you have no problems of
Yeah. That's a good question. The reason for that is that you pay in units of inductance.
Again, so there's still inductance.
Squid inductance. In this case, it's the squid inductance. So you cannot make the squid loop itself arbitrarily big. This 10 picohenry to 1 nanohenry is the range that is allowed, if you will. The reason for that is the following. If you have a noise current, we have these noise currents associated with the resistors. They produce a noise flux in the squid, and this noise flux is current times inductance.
Oh, okay.
So this is why, yes, okay. It's purely, so to say, noise limited. Yes, that's one reason. The other one also, some other parameters are also not scaling very nicely if you increase the inductance.
It's linear, the noise is linear with the inductance. So it doesn't help with signal-to-noise?
No, it does not help with the signal-to-noise, The issue, in a way, is you want to maximize the area that you can pick up, but at the same time get not too big an inductance. So this is why there are some design constraints. I'll come to these, I think, later on that limit the squid inductance. Indeed. All right. So squid arrays. These are nice devices because they allow you to play around with parameters that in this circuit are very helpful to have. But their basic principle is, of course, you correlate the signal in all of the squids, but the intrinsic noise of the array elements is uncorrelated, so you gain in terms of signal to noise, if you will, or in terms of noise with respect to the measurement, you gain with a number of elements. You also gain in terms of what we call the dynamic range with a square root of n. And you'd gain independent of whether you use a serial array or a parallel array, but the already mentioned coupled energy sensitivity does not change. So you do not gain in units of h. But what you can do, and we do that very often, is you can play around with these serial arrays, parallel arrays, or combination of those. And with these parameters, you can design output impedances, trans impedances, very flexibly. So it's particularly, as you will see later on, particularly helpful when you have signal boosters and other amplifier stages. And the price you pay is the power dissipation. Of course, that scales with a number of squids, assuming identical squids. But they are very helpful. They have another aspect that is also sometimes a problem in an experiment. In order for a squid array to behave single squid-like, it requires to have the same flux through all the elements, signal flux, but also background flux. And that also includes flux offset. And here I just want to explain what you hear sometimes, trap flux, what that is. So niobium is a type 2 superconductor, and type 2 superconductors have the property of trapping flux sometimes. And this shows a measurement of these so-called Aprikosov of vortices. So these are little islands of normal conducting material. There's a circulating current going around, and there's exactly one flux quantum integral over flux, over the loop here. And people here have now, a couple of years back, tested the behavior of a type 2 superconductor when you cool it down in different fields, and they use these stripes of different width, and they have found that the cooling field at which you obtain flux-free cooling scales with 1 over the lateral dimension. In other words, if you cool down your superconductor and these aprikosa 46s form, you want to make your niobium structure smaller than the vortex-vortex distance. And that helps to indeed avoid flux trapping and is really a necessary ingredient in designing a squid array that works. Because I will show you what happens when you have a squid array V-phi curve and that trap flux. So this is a V-phi curve of a 16 squid series array. And it looks like a single squid. You see one overall V-phi curve. And if you have trap flux, then the overall voltage, the maximum voltage is reduced. You have these site minima, these so-called random flux offset, just from, let's say, a vortex sitting here, but not sitting here. So it's just shifted by 10, 20% of a phi naught. This degrades the squid array performance and also can introduce noise because this vortex can move around and create a parasitic flux signal in the element. Okay, so now I want to talk a little about noise performances of these devices. This is all well understood by now. The junctions can be at least numerically modeled very nicely. And you can look up textbooks by now and look for the scaling that you should expect from the squid noise, or here as the theoretical coupled energy sensitivity, for instance, with temperature or with circuit parameters that, to a certain extent, you choose freely. So let's start with the temperature. So this is all classical thermal noise, so you would expect the noise to go down with temperature. And you cool down your device to the lowest possible operational temperature, and you sort of hope that there's no excess noise of some sorts. And what you observe, and this is an example from about 10 years back when we looked into this noise scaling with temperature a little more precisely, is the following. So the red curve is measured flux noise at 4.2 Kelvin. The blue curve is the measured flux noise at 310 millikelvin. And what you've seen is that while the white noise goes down with temperature, as you would expect it from this formula, the low frequency noise actually goes up. So this is sort of counterintuitive. You can parametrize this and compare different devices, not only devices from us, for instance. Maybe it is a sort of a process problem. We have some impurities or something. But colleagues from Heidelberg did that recently as well, and they used our values and also theirs. You even can find alpha is the exponent by which the 1 over f to the power of alpha noise scales. You can parametrize this noise and compare different devices of different designs, different materials, different people having handled them, and you find some sort of universal behavior. So this is puzzling. There are indications that this noise comes from random reversal of surface spins, impurities, and there are a number of suggestions what those surface spins could be. Dangling bonds of the silicon-silicon oxide interface, adsorbed oxygen. Earlier today we heard that oxygen molecules are paramagnetic, so if they are absorbed at the surface and then at low temperatures condense and thermally activate, by thermal activation move around, they can create magnetic noise. It could be nuclear spins or metal-induced gap state. Nobody right now knows precisely. There are indeed measurements and also, so to say, chemical measurements of adsorbed oxygen that show that it's there, but still an open question what the origin for that is. But for you, maybe the take-home message is that there is typically in many of the devices that we fabricate, but also other people, there is a sort of a crossover frequency below which the low temperature noise actually is worse than the higher temperature noise, and that it is sometimes, especially if you want to measure at very low temperature, very low frequencies, better to operate at higher temperatures. All right, so I will now talk about some examples of sensors that we've developed. And the first one is a current sensor to read out a TES stand. TES stands for Transition Edge Sensor. And I'm not going to talk about much about these devices, but they are highly sensitive photon counters, cryogenically operated. And in the ALPS experiment, the Analyte particle experiment at DAISY, these devices are used by now. So this experiment is a light shining through a wall experiment. So you have a strong laser on one end of a wall. You combine this high laser, strong laser field with a huge magnet, and weakly interacting slim particles may form here. Those travel through the wall. On the other side of the wall, there's another magnet similar to this one, or more or less identical. And you have also a cavity, and then the inverse Primakov effect, I guess is the name, can occur, and you have a photon here, and you want to detect this photon. So this is the ALPS experiment. In its first version, it was used using CCD cameras, and now they switched to TSs. And so a TS, from a readout perspective, is some sort of resistive sensor. It acts as a current source. Its resistance and some other parameters are given here. And if a photon is absorbed, it's a calorimeter. So you get a pulse signal when a single photon is absorbed, and you get a stronger pulse signal when two photons are absorbed. And these currents are typically in the range of about 100 nanoamps. And the relevant time scales here are in the range of microseconds. And this device operates at 100 millikelvin, has some current noise by itself, and you want to read it out. And a squid is in a way the natural current sensor for this. And we built a two-stage current sensor for this readout problem. This is schematically shown here. So we have a front-end squid that is coupled to the input coil. We have a feedback coil. We can do the FLL that I mentioned. And we have a two-stage cascade, as is shown here. And we read out this front-end squid with a 16 squid series array. Here are a few parameters of the device. So this all is operated millikelvin. It has to be, and it is magnetically robust. The inductance is very small, 2 nanohenries, which would not be practical for any wire-wound coils. And these are the numbers, the performance in terms of picoamps per square hertz and power dissipation. This is a chip layout, so the compact chip that comes with two independent channels. This is, by the way, the V-phi curve that is asymmetric for some specific reasons, but it still looks like a single squid V-phi curve, although it is a two-stage device. And this is then the experimental setup. So we combined our current sensor with single photon counters based on TSs from NIST. You can see those here. These are little petal-shaped chips, silicon chips. The TS sits right in the middle. And they came up with a very nice and simple scheme to couple fibers, optical fibers, to these two devices. You wire them directly and you read them out. And this is, for instance, the signal that you obtain for, in this case, 930 nanometers, although the devices are optimized for 1064 and are also used at 1064 nanometers at DAISY. But we are using them also to characterize single photon sources from quantum dots. And these are just the plots that I have. So you see, you can discriminate, you can really count one photon, two photons, three photons, and so on with these calorimeters. Okay, so now I switch to a more, to this audience, at least partly for you of this audience, a more common configuration. That is, you have some sort of superconducting wire wound pickup coil, and you want to read that out. And this is a configuration that people use in biomagnetism a lot, so subtometry, NMR, NQR, and so on. And the pickup inductances are typically in the range of 100 nanohenries to microhenry. And we have seen this picture, I think, earlier today. This is the schematic of the CASPA proposal that also has pickup loops in this ballpark of about a microhenry. And from the CASPA group, I got a more, let's say, detailed picture of their setup. They have the liquid xenon down here in a bore of a magnet at a somewhat higher temperature that we are operating. This is a helium liquid helium dewar. There are two squids up here and a field compensation region, and I wonder whether this picture also inspires somebody to look how squids are doing in magnetic fields. Anyway, so this liquid xenon is exposed to very, very high magnetic fields, which is experimentally also a problem because I told you the squids need lower fields, for instance, to be even only cooled down without any trapped flux. And also the maximum signal frequencies are very, very high. So here a conventional flux loop will not work. It here really requires to make use of some alternative methods to read out such high signals. The squid intrinsically, as we have seen, should be able to see these signals. Okay, so we have developed a whole family of squid sensors for this purpose, and the schematic is again shown here. This is sort of the outline of our chip. We have the double transformer to couple the input coil to the squid. Here we have these damping elements. These are resistors, in this case, with capacitors, so they would, for instance, produce current noise at higher frequencies. But they're necessary to get the overall performance right. There are some additional features, RF filters, and feedback into the input, so you can also make the input high impedance. That is sometimes helpful to avoid crosstalk from one channel to another.
What do those lines like this mean? What's represented by that?
These are RF filters. So these are sort of, they should indicate RF filters. So you don't want, 100 megahertz going down to your squid. As I've shown before, the squids are still sensitive there, and they would not be fed back, of course, and this is indicating here. Okay, so sometimes it's also necessary to limit the maximum current into your input coil, let's say when you polarize samples, and you can also make use of squids here by using them more as switches, as flux-controlled switches to limit the maximum current. So you, in a way, you switch them from superconducting to normal conducting by applying, well, half a fine note to any of the elements of this array. Okay, so these devices come in six sizes, from extra small to extra, extra large. I'm not going to go through all the details here, but they are by now complex cryo-electronic circuits. And here are, for the people who are interested in, the input inductances, the couplings, and the current noise of the bare current sensor, and also the coupled energy sensitivity in H-bar, when these devices are operated at 4.2 Kelvin. And if you would use these devices and make what I called a ideally matched magnetometer, so a wire of the corresponding inductance, no parasitics, you will end up with magnetometers that are in the femtotesla or deep below femtotesla per square hertz. Sorry. That's a good point. Here I just considered the white noise values. That's true.
This is to what frequencies, from what above 100 hertz roughly?
No, it is, let me go back. It is at 4 Kelvin, this excess noise kicks in, let's say, at about 10. So let's say not the excess noise that we see at low temperatures, but anyway.
No, but at high frequencies,
yes.
For the experiment,
yes.
It's not a problem, right?
Depends on the experiment, again. Yeah. So at sub-hertz frequencies, you already see an increase in
yes,
noise.
Yes, but I'm thinking about the Casper experiment.
Yeah, Casper experiment is actually at too high a frequency, if you will, but I think they start also in the kilohertz range, if I remember correctly. So yeah, for this application...
You're not limited by the 100
hertz? No, not at all. Yeah. So it's really above 10 hertz at 4 Kelvin, we are squid noise limited. Okay, so where was I? All right, so this is these are the numbers for these different sizes of the devices. And this improvement in coupled energy sensitivity when you go to larger sizes of the input coil is just due to the fact that you always have the coupling losses that I mentioned earlier, but they are less and less relevant the more turns on the input, the higher the inductance on the input is. Okay, so what we also in a way used at least the same input size and so on for a family of sensors that is meant to be used at lower temperatures. I showed you that the white noise reasonably well goes down with temperature, at least to about 300 millikelvin for our devices. And here it then is helpful to have an integrated two-stage cascade. Again, you see here this front-end squid that has the input coupling and the readout squid integrated on the same chip. So why is that? And that is because there is always a somewhat of a room temperature electronics noise contribution in case of a single stage. And if you go to the effort of cooling down, you want to make sure that you really get the best overall noise performance. And the room temperature electronics noise contribution typically does not scale with temperature. So you would run into this offset noise. And this is why for the, we say, typically below 1 Kelvin, it really makes sense to have a two-stage configuration. And all the additional features are the same as for the one-stage versions. Again, the sizes, I'll skip over this. And here then you see that when you go down, in our case, to typically 300 millikelvin, you really improve by this factor of 13 or 14 between 4.2 kelvin and 0.3 millikelvin in coupled energy sensitivity. These are the numbers that I gave divided by 14, which
the square root of
epsilon goes with t, but square root of sb goes with square root of t. Okay, so this is about a factor of 3 higher than what we would expect from the equation that I showed you before. So, but I have to say that also the h bar over 2 number that was mentioned yesterday, or generally the quantum number, that is of course the limit of a completely bare squid, uncoupled. So in a way, not very realistic if you do not have any structure to couple your signal into. So if we plug in our numbers, temperature, and so on, we see that we are a factor of 3 higher than what is theoretically expected. And the question, of course, is how is it possible to get to the theoretical limit? And when I introduced this device, I omitted, I mentioned it, but I omitted here in the discussion, the parasitic junction capacitance that is associated with this planar structure. And this junction capacitance is, in our case, coming from the junction itself, from the junction area itself, but also from the surrounding overlap area. And it amounts to about 0.4 picofarad in total. So this LC circuit, as I mentioned earlier, needs to be dampened, and this dampening requirement translates into a design parameter, if you will. R squared times C needs to be smaller than this expression over here. So you cannot simply make R arbitrarily large in order to go down in coupled energy sensitivity when you have a fixed temperature. So what you have to do is you have to reduce the junction size. And we are in the process of doing this by making use of modern thin film technologies, in our case, electron beam lithography and some other technologies. So this is now a picture, an SEM picture of a niobium bottom wire. And we have used electron beam lithography to make a mask and etch out a junction maser, so the barrier is somewhere in here. So with our technology, we can principally go down to a junction size of 0.2 by 0.2 microns square, so that would be about a factor of 100 reduction in size. We are not going to push that limit right away, but we are going to make an intermediate step and are just in the process development stage of making our junctions about 0.8 by 0.8 micron square. This reduces the capacitance, we can increase the resistance, and so we expect, again, at 300 millikelvin, to achieve these about a factor of two and a half-ish improvement in coupled energy sensitivity.
Are there fundamental limits of how small
Fundamental limits, maybe not, but practical ones. Because when you increase the, when you decrease the junction junction area, you need to increase the critical current density by a factor of 100. So it's more a practical problem to have the oxide thinner and thinner, and avoid pinholes and defects in the junction area. But I don't think there is a practical limitation. There's eventually, fundamental limitation. There's eventually also a practical limitation because the volume where you dissipate and in the junction there's also power dissipation. If you make that volume smaller and smaller, you have a harder and harder time to really get the junctions cold. So this may be another aspect. So we are, again, trying to improve that step by step and integrate these smaller junctions into our devices. Okay, the last minutes of my talk I will use to discuss not a front-end device, but a second-stage squid device that is helpful, we think, to avoid a problem that is very common in squid setups, and that is electromagnetic interference. We have seen spectra here with lines. Often you can attribute those lines with electromagnetic interference to the squid sensor directly, which is bad because that means that your magnetic shielding is not good. But there's also interference along the wiring, of course, that gets the signal from the cold into the room temperature area, and that can be, of course, also EMI shielded, but there are, again, practical aspects that this shielding may not be optimal for various reasons. You cannot make massive metal shields that go into the helium cryostat, for instance. So there are oftentimes also interferences along the readout line. So how can that look? It's, again, shown here in this little cartoon. So you have your squid here, there's an input signal, you get the voltage across the squid, and then you have the line, and you pick up some sort of interference along the line, and that is amplified together with your signal. So what to do about that? So there is a means to a large extent reduce that, and that is a squid with a differential output. So the idea is, again, very simple. You take two identical squids, but you invert the polarity of its input, so as shown here. So the signal couples with inverted polarity, so therefore also the squid responds with an inverted polarity signal. The pickup is common, and you use this is the next slide then, you use a differential amplifier to read out these two halves of a differential squid, and you can cancel out the common mode signal. All right, so what does that require? It requires that you have two identical, as best as you can, identical squid sensors. And this is a proof of concept demonstration here. So in this case, we used two 16 squid series arrays, A and B, in this case unloaded at 4.2 Kelvin. So the dark green curve is squid A only, B off, read out with a differential amplifier, and the lighter green curve is device B with A off inverted because it was out read out on the negative, and then you combine those two and you get a smooth and factor of two increased overall combined V-phi curve, and then you can cool that down. You can check how the V-phi curve looks when you load it, and this looks the way we expected it. And This diff squid is particularly helpful, we think, as a second stage, as I mentioned, because squid arrays principally conserve the coupled energy sensitivity, but practically not. So you can think of something that is a two-stage cascade with a front end optimized for lowest noise and read it out with a cold diff squid and have the wiring to your differential amplifier at room temperature. And we designed a real whopper of a squid, diff squid. It's a serial parallel squid array arrangement. It has two halves that each have 80 squids in serial, four of those in parallel. So this sensor, this current sensor, has 1,280 Johnson junctions alone. The total input inductance is of course, increased. You can optimize and play around with a ratio of serial to parallel to get dynamic resistances that match to your differential amplifier. Again, the only price you pay is the power dissipation, which is comparably high for a squid sensor. But it also gives you, for a squid at least, a very large signal, 3 millivolts peak into 2 × 50 ohms load, for instance. So with this, I think I'm at the end of my talk. Low temperature DC squid current sensors, or sensors in general, 50 years after their invention, are really, I think, reliable cryo-electronic circuits. Thin film technology is used to fabricate them. There are various measurements, both in metrology, but also in science and fundamental physics and other fields that these devices are used for. We at PTB have developed over the last years a multi-purpose niobium-based squid current sensor family. They come in single squids and integrated two-stage cascades. And I showed you the noise performance at 4 Kelvin and below. And among other things, I think for this community, these devices may be really good to make highly sensitive magnetometers. So I'm at the end of my slides, and thank you for your attention.
So any questions?
First, why in the last 20 years no one dedicated energy to RF squid? Do you have some different? And the second, if it's possible to think in a single photon detector put inside the radio frequency cavities for see the photons at these frequencies, because it is our problem.
Let me start with the second question.
Okay.
It's easier. So the detector, the single photon counter that I showed, is a calorimeter. So there are concepts for calorimeters also for terahertz single photons. But the photon energy is, of course, much smaller. So that makes it much, much harder to read it out calorimetrically. So the first question is why there has been less and less interest in RF squids, yeah, over the last years. So the noise scaling with RF squids is, in principle, with I think omega squared of the pump frequency. I forget. I'm not an expert. So that is at least in the 1980s, 90s, or if I remember correctly, the noise performance of RF squids there was undercut by the DC squids that came up at that time. But that may change when you go to higher pump frequencies with with better performance these days. And interestingly enough, there is one flavor of the of the RF squid, that is the dissipationless RF squid, where you use similar to the Johnson parametric amplifier, where you use the squid not in the resistive mode, the RF squid, but in the dispersive mode. That has gained interest in recent years, and the reason here is not so much that you can improve on noise performance, but that you can read out many channels at different frequencies. So the buzzword is frequency domain multiplexing with one coaxial cable. So this is why people over the last years have again, in a way, rediscovered the RF slash AC, AC squid. Yes, that's the answer.
Any other questions?
So, you know, gravitational wave, cryogenic gravitational wave detector drove the need for new quantum gravity squid. And in the old days, John Clark's group tried to produce that for other reasons too. But the progress is very short. Now, 20, maybe 30 years ago, Carelli in Italy claimed by 5H squared. So 30.
5H or 5H bar?
No, he said 5H. So okay. I think we should use H bar. So anyway, that your noises compared to quantum time squared is the energy sensitivity is 100 times better, but this is 300 millikelvin. Now, it would be very nice if you can get H, 5H bar squared.
Well, yeah, that's in a way it is a problem. That's that we discussed it over lunch. So
a certain temperature, you have a hot electron effect and so on.
Right.
But question is, for the you are a real expert. It seems like your institution had most systematic development effort. Other people didn't do it. Even quantum design is not very good. The market is limited. So, from your point of view, is there any way to reduce the energy sensitivity resolution to the 5H bar?
Well, I showed you that in terms of reducing the junction area, we are working on it to getting let's say, to the range of 20 H-bar, 15 maybe, depending on technological problems. But what you said, indeed, in terms of cooling the devices down, is there's room for improvement, at least for our device. And we know that the electron phonon decoupling kicks in comparably early, meaning at a higher temperatures for us. And we think this has to do with the poor thermal heat capacity in the resistance material that we are using. So I don't know. I don't want to risk saying a factor of five, another factor of five is possible. But this is indeed something that we have seen. When we compare the scaling of the energy sensitivity with temperature in our device and other people's device, we see that we level off at higher temperatures. So there should be no principal reason to go to maybe another factor of 2 to 3 lower in temperature in junction shunt resistor temperature. So maybe, to put it this way, but it needs to optimize the thermal conductance of the resistor material, and eventually you will be limited. Even if that is intrinsically very, very, very good, you will still be limited in the rate by which you can dump heat from the electron system into the phonon system and how well that couples through the interface. So maybe another factor of 2 or 3 in temperature is possible.
Yeah, I was wondering, I mean, the squid, when you measure magnetic field, the squid is operated with a feedback mechanism. Is there any experience how much the signal that you actually measure is still influenced by the fact that you add energy to the system in order to get information out? Is this the same as the energy dissipation of the squid, or is this related somehow or not?
Well, there is a noise contribution. I think I mentioned that. So if you, in principle, there is no noise improvement or where do I have it? Or noise degradation if you do feedback, right? So there is, however, I think I have it somewhere. Sorry. Okay, let's do it here. So there is noise associated with sources, the resistor, but also flux bias sources that couple into the feedback coil. So you see a certain degradation in noise. But you can measure this, you can estimate it, you can optimize it. So I think it is no practical problem that you have degraded noise performance and feedback.
Well, my question was a little bit different. In the fact that imagine you measure periodic magnetic signal,
yeah.
You get the information out of the periodic signal in order to stabilize your operation, your readout of the grid, mm-hmm. enters a feedback. That means you, in principle, you have some artificial electronic delay where you add energy to the system again. Does this, is there any experience how much your frequency measurement is affected?
Well, I think you can model this when you know all the frequency responses of your individual elements. So you have always a finite error signal in feedback systems. You can estimate this, and you can in principle also correct for that. So maybe that answers your question.
Has this ever been done by anyone?
Yes, in digital feedback systems, for instance, people check the error signal and compensate for that reconstruct their original input signal with this error signal, finite error signal correction.
Okay. So, well, let's thank the speaker again.